When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello, sweetie.
Hello, darling. Hey, I've got evidence that this podcast is actually changing lives.
Go on.
Well, it's changed my life. After last week's episode on plastics,
yeah.
I've stopped using cling film. I've stopped using tinfoil.
And stopped buying the Lucozade.
Yeah. Why are you so obsessed with the idea that I'm drinking a lot of Lucozade? Yeah, so I'm obsessively putting stuff in Tupperware now, and it's such a good feeling.
That's good.
I'm thinking of having a Tupperware party.
Don't call me. right. No, so I had a thought on this after the last episode. I don't know why we didn't think about it or mention it. There should be public water fountains at train stations, in public spaces, all of that. You know, why do you end up having to buy plastic water bottles? Because there's nowhere to fill up a water bottle.
Yeah, and what's interesting is my wife is American,
yeah,
and she lived in New York for 20 years. Everywhere you go in New York, there are water fountains. And
Definitely. I think it's because the companies probably don't want it, because it means, I mean, it's maybe completely wrong, but because otherwise then they wouldn't be able to sell so much water. I mean, if there was public water fountains, my wife is very good at, when we're at an airport or something, finding the water fountain, but they're pretty few and far between.
But I hear what you're saying, but using America as an example, surely if anywhere is going to be capitalism,
yeah,
water bottles gone mad, you would, yeah, expect it to be there, and they've got water fountains everywhere.
You can fill up there, you can fill up anywhere.
That's right. They've got one at our leisure centre, and I went to use it the other day.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Sorry, I was just being nice. I was just being silly. Yeah, carry on. I'm really interested. I want to know about the leisure centre.
No,
you went to fill up at the leisure centre.
Never telling you
the end
of that
really
story.
No, I really want to know. Oh, no, that's what my mother used to do to me.
It's going to be an unresolved story.
No,
it's going to be like going, ba-ba-ba-da-da-da.
Please, I want to know.
It's unresolved.
I want to know about the leisure centre.
No,
honestly,
Ed. Hopefully, you will learn the future episodes. Not to be quite so facetious.
Think of the listeners.
I'm going
to. They want to know the leisure centre story, don't you, listeners?
The trouble is now there is so much weight of expectation on,
yeah,
the leisure centre story,
yeah,
that it couldn't possibly,
no,
be
honestly,
a good story.
This could be like the new
even if it
this
was Clement
like the new
Freud
serial
telling it.
This could be like the new serial, honestly. You know, what happened to the leisure centre? People will be like doing sketches of the leisure centre, the car park,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
the route you,
yeah,
took,
yeah,
where was Jean, you know, all of that stuff. Reddit threads.
Tune in next week for,
yeah,
what happened at the leisure
what
centre.
Happened at the leisure,
yeah,
centre.
Yeah.
Right.
So aside from the leisure centre, what are we talking about this week?
Right, we're talking about quantitative easing. Do you know what quantitative easing is?
I do. It's when the government pumps money into the,
yeah,
economy to try and stimulate it.
I mean, honestly, this is like hard to get your head around, but it is basically the government printing money. And the question about quantitative easing is, because I think it's kind of both simple and very complicated as to what happens to the money, people tend not to talk about it, but there's a kind of hidden, there's multiple hidden stories here about who's benefited from QE, as it's called, whether it's been used for environmental purposes, whether it could be used for better purposes. And we're going to be talking about that with two people who can help us wrap our heads around it.
And quantitative easing is not just one thing. It's not just the way that we did it after the financial crisis. There are lots of different ways of doing it.
Well, it's happened after the financial crisis. It's all in the light of the financial crisis. But it's a bit like the Leisure Centre. Tune in for, you know, more soon on QE.
And we will be joined by comedian Eleanor Morton, who will be is suggesting some ideas which could be reasons to be cheerful.
Can I tell you my reason to be cheerful?
Oh, here we go. This is going to be interesting.
Machado pinwheels the bat. Nobody on base. Two men out. Bottom of the ninth. 5-1 Red Sox. Sale winds. He fires. Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship. The Boston Red Sox beat the Los Angeles Dodgers 5-1.
So what do you think that was?
Something droning on about the Boston Red Sox.
That was Joe Castiglione, who is the color announcer for WEEI, which is the Red Sox radio station. Oh, shut up. just because it's the Leisure Centre. And it was the Red Sox winning the World Series, which they did earlier this week. I'm a big Red Sox fan, as you know. I wasn't there for it. Oh. It was in the middle of the night.
Oh, dear.
All right. now I know how it feels. Anyway, it's a big deal.
Congratulations.
Do you know why it's a big deal?
No. You've gone on about this before. Something to do with they've not won it for a millennium or something.
Safe
I thought it was a safe space.
Have I made it an unsafe space?
Yes, you have. Yeah.
I want to take it back. It's an amazing team. Best Red Sox team I've ever seen. After years of heartbreak, we now had heart lifting.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You were personally responsible. Definitely. In a small way, I'm sure.
What's your reason to be cheerful? It better be good after that one.
Tonight I'm going to see a documentary about one of my favourite bands, Slow Club, who are on hiatus at the moment, and it's sort of a warts and all documentary about what it's like to be in a band. They're a duo, and when duos have been working together after a certain amount of time, these schisms, these cracks start
artistic
to appear.
Differences.
Yeah, exactly.
It's often over the issue of Leisure Centre.
Yes. So that's my reason to be cheerful.
Well, it sounds great.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined now by Fran Boyt, who is Executive Director of Positive Money, and Josh Ryan Collins, who's Head of Research at the UCL Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me on.
You're going to sort of kind of get us to sort of understand the ABC of QE. So this is a kind of really important task. Why don't we start with Josh? Just what is quantitative easing?
So quantitative easing is a rather complicated sounding term for when the Bank of England attempts to essentially lower longer term interest rates by buying assets from the financial sector. The reason it does it is because short term interest rates after the financial crisis reached essentially zero. So the base rate, the policy rate that you hear about every quarter. So they decided then that they would target longer term interest rates, so 5-year or 10-year interest rates typically on government bonds. And the main thing they've done is buy government bonds that are out there held by institutional investors like pension funds and insurance companies. And the idea is by taking those bonds out of the market, the safest type of bonds, government bonds, those financial investors then choose to buy more risky bonds, in particular bonds issued by companies, for example, that in the real economy. And that the idea is that actually pumps up real economic activity.
Do you want to add your own ABC of QE, Fran?
Sure. I mean, that was a very good description of it. And the kind of theory behind it is that, you know,
it's printing money, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's money creation by the central bank on a vast scale.
445 billion by the Bank of England.
Exactly.
Yeah?
And
I mean, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. And the idea is that it will stimulate the economy. The problem is that, as Josh described, it goes into financial markets and it basically stays there. It pushes up asset prices, but it
asset
doesn't...
Asset prices means...
So cost of stock shares, it actually ends up pushing up property prices as well.
The Bank of England buys bonds, most of them issued by the government, but bought by pension funds. So they say to the pension funds, we're buying the bonds.
Yeah.
Yep. The bond prices go up, correct?
Yes. Because they're taken out of the market, there's more demand for them.
More demand. So the prices go up.
Mm-hmm.
What happens next?
So then the yields, which is the opposite of the price, the interest rate falls essentially.
Yeah. So the amount people get back on the bonds. Yeah.
So essentially what you're doing is you're replacing the bonds held by the institutional investors with money, newly created money that's been created by the Bank of England. And the interest rate on Bank of England money is zero. It's essentially, so what they want to do is use that money to buy other assets, which does have a return, does have a higher interest rate. The institutional investors, the pension fund.
Bank of England's buying from the pension funds. It's going to make them more likely to buy other bonds.
Exactly. In the real economy, that's a theory. Yeah.
And it's good that the interest rates are low because it's cheaper for businesses to borrow.
Yes.
And then that stimulates the economy.
Yeah.
Can I ask another dumbish question?
Like, there's no question that's dumb on this issue.
Okay. Does sort of pumping all this new money out of nowhere into the economy, does it make the money, is it worth less? Does it devalue it?
It doesn't have that straightforward effect. And where we see it having the biggest effect is on wealth increases of asset prices, as I said. So actually, by the Bank of England's own research, it's made the top 10% of households in this country richer by
350,000.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, 350,000 each.
So just again, the transmission mechanism. Lots of demand from the Bank of England for these bonds. Prices tend to rise. That includes stock market prices. Mainly it's rich people who've got money in the stock market. They get richer.
Yeah, you can just imagine like more money for a finite amount of financial assets, they go up.
Yeah.
But the point behind it was trying to get, as Josh said, banks to lend and trying to get a stimulus in the real economy where most people live and work, and it didn't do that.
And so you think it hasn't really supported economic growth? You said it's had these sort of problematic distributional effects, but you don't think it's really supported growth? Because the Bank of England would say, would they, this has helped stop the economy, you know, going off a cliff.
I mean, positive money's position is always like, maybe it was the best tool available in a hurry in 2009 when it first started. But the point is, it's keeping our economy structured in a way that we're relying on asset price inflation and high levels of household debt to kind of keep this, you know, very sluggish growth happening in the UK economy. And now we're at a stage where, you know, wealth inequality is obviously like really out of control in this country.
And it's made it worse.
It's made it hugely worse. And so the negative consequences massively outweigh the positive ones. And 10 years on from the crash, we need to be thinking of doing things differently.
Right.
You know, they expanded the QE program 2 years ago after the Brexit announcement. So we were, you know, very much, we got a, you know, a letter signed by loads of economists saying this isn't a good idea. We could be doing things differently.
Okay, we're going to come on to that in a minute. So are you in the same camp on this?
Broadly speaking, yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say that QE did prevent a worse recession, and it stabilised asset prices.
Yeah.
There's definite evidence it's supported growth in that crisis period, but it's been sort of decreasing returns ever since then.
Right.
And as Franz says, the inequality effects, I think, at some point start to overweigh the other effects.
And before we get onto the sort of solutions, there's also another bad effect. And there's been an important paper, I think, written by some people at the LSE, London School of Economics, on this, because the purchase of corporate bonds, which is a smaller part of QE, very small part, relatively small part, but also that's by the Bank of England, but also the European Central Bank, it's mainly gone into carbon intensive industries, not green industries. So they've been buying these corporate bonds, and it's helped like fossil fuel companies more than renewable companies.
Yeah, I mean, right. It's essentially the bond purchase program has replicated the market.
Yeah.
And the market itself is very skewed towards big established companies with AAA credit.
BP, banks. Exxon, those kind of places. Yeah.
So essentially by imitating the market and being market neutral, the bank has effectively created a bit of a carbon lock-in and a skew towards carbon intensive sectors.
And I think the corporate bond purchase scheme and QE in general like brings into the spotlight a bit a question mark over the role of the central bank and how monetary policy works with fiscal policy, essentially. And, you know, there's some serious critiques over corporate bond purchases because mainstream orthodox thinking is that central banks are neutral. So the idea that central banks then go and pick corporations and buy their bonds is problematic in terms of mainstream thinking. And then the fact that they are choosing disproportionately corporates with high fossil fuel sectors is, again...
I mean, the figures are quite shocking. This is a paper by Dimitri Zengelis and colleagues at the LSE. It says that 62% of the European Central Bank budget, I think I'm understanding this, we've gone to manufacturing and electricity production, and 49% in relation to the Bank of England. Mm. I mean, that seems very concentrated on broadly carbon intensive.
The central banks essentially don't discriminate between carbon intensive or non-carbon intensive.
And like where we are with central banks and climate change is like it's been exciting how they've stepped forward. And
Mark Carney in particular.
But they're looking at it through a risk and financial stability lens.
Yeah.
They're not so happy about being pushed on their monetary policy operations. And that's work that obviously Josh and I and others are doing to say, well, it's incoherent to say you understand climate change is a risk to financial stability, but your monetary policy, you're just ignoring climate change. But I think, you know, there's that whole bigger question of, you know, should central banks be choosing corporates to buy bonds in? Like, isn't that a role for fiscal policy?
For government, for, in other words, government spending, fiscal policy.
Well, and therefore, the whole question of monetary policy and fiscal policy and how they work together comes into question. You know, that's obviously what positive money works on as well.
So can you give me some better ways of doing QE then?
Sure thing. It is as simple as creating new money. So obviously, people that want to see better jobs in the economy, you know, higher employment in sustainable areas would want to see that money going to places that would create those jobs. So, you know, on a very simple level, it is just around where you direct it. Currently, we've seen the new money created just go straight into financial markets, into pushing up asset prices. A very simple way of doing it would be crediting it to the government's account and they can spend it how they see fit. The different proposals on the table from various different economists or organisations like Positive Money have been looking at doing... at having different outcomes, basically.
And so there's something called people's QE. Is this what you so-called?
Yeah, so...
Is that what you're talking about? And what would that mean?
So again, even people's QE has been talked about in different ways, and depending on what you're trying to do. So, for example...
Depending on which people are talking about it.
There was a proposal, like, a while ago by Colin Hines and Richard Murphy. Actually, Jeremy Corbyn picked it up in his leadership campaign. And they were kind of just very... specifically saying that this money created by the central bank should be going into government spending.
So that would be like just building houses or buying what sort of, you know, building hospitals or schools.
Yeah. It'd be the government deciding that, not the bank.
There's kind of different lenses you need to look through. One, what's your objective? Are you trying to target inflation, or are you looking at increasing employment, or are you looking at reducing private sector debt? And what's your institutional arrangement for doing so? So you could create and allocate money through the Bank of England, or, you know, but one of the reasons that this is quite a exciting and radical idea is that it does force the question of how do we get the central bank and the treasury to work together for kind of macroeconomic policy objectives, which is, you know, better employment or whatever we want to see.
Yeah, so I mean, what I would say is there's been lots of different proposals, but there have been two main ideas about how you might do this. One of the main ideas that has been pushed quite hard by many sort of more right-wing or free market-oriented economists is this idea of a helicopter drop named after Milton Friedman, where you literally would just credit households' accounts with money. So you give everyone $1,500. Actually, Australia did.
I mean, Adair Turner, I think, former director of the Financial Services Authority.
Yeah, Adair Turner.
The CBI has proposed something similar.
Yeah, it's quite a popular proposal. I'm actually less supportive of that proposal because I think if you give everyone, you know, the poorer people might spend it definitely on buying stuff, you know, and paying for their rent. But richer people might not. Richer people might just save the money or they might use it to buy even more expensive houses and, you know, invest in assets. So I think a better solution, a better approach, and I wrote a report called Strategic Quantitative Easing a few years ago on this, would be for the central bank to buy bonds issued by, for example, the British Business Bank or a Green Investment Bank if we hadn't privatised it.
And that British Business Bank and the Green Investment Bank do what?
So they are essentially committed to lending to building houses, investing in green energy infrastructure, stuff that you know is going to actually support the economy in a sustainable way. Another option would be to buy to buy bonds for local, to enable local authorities.
And how is that strategic QE, as you call it, different from what is being done at the moment when they're, when the Bank of England is buying bonds from...
So at the moment, the bank's buying government bonds mainly, also corporate bonds, have already been purchased in the secondary market. And hoping...
The secondary market means pension funds and so on.
The private sector's bought the bonds already and hoping, essentially, that that money will be spent in the real economy. But in fact, they're free to do whatever they want. They can sit on the money. They can spend it on buying shares in other companies.
So they being...
The institutional investors, the pension funds, etc. So in a sense, it's unstrategic. And, it's sort of hoping the market will do the right thing.
Forgive me for being very, very simplistic about this, but if you had that British Business Bank or Green Investment Bank issuing these bonds, why is it better to have the Bank of England buying them? What does that get you, that them just selling them the bonds on the open market doesn't get you?
Well, you might get a lower interest rate.
Right.
Which would be useful.
Right. So it's a way of supporting investment the government wants to see. Yeah.
And the other point about when the Bank of England buys any kind of bond, it has a very strong signalling effect on the wider economy. It essentially says these kinds of assets are sound as safe and everyone, so it can crowd in more private
That's really
finance.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
You support his strategic QE.
I do, and I think, you know, there are various proposals on the table, and that, in a way, is in a way most close to what the current QE looks like. And, it, you know, there's absolutely no reason that they shouldn't... If they were going to consider buying 10 billion of corporate bonds, they shouldn't have considered buying some bonds in the Green Investment Bank, even though it's been privatised, all the Business Investment Bank. However, just building on the helicopter money proposal, I still think that that is an interesting one to consider because of where we are with high households and private debt in this
and
country.
And very low growth. I mean, in the budget in this week, in a way, it's been the least remarked part of the budget.
Yeah.
It, you know, growth is like between 1.3 and 1.6%, which is incredibly low for the coming years. And then we know there's some reasons, specific reasons for that, but that is, that's not good.
Especially when in absolute terms, our private debt is higher than it's ever been. It's like unsecured debt, I think, is around 300 billion. And, you know, that's the biggest kind of risk to financial instability, to destabilising the economy again. So, you know, there's obviously some really good work on how we need to look at regulating high cost credit, etc. But a lot of campaigners and economists are coming out and saying we actually have to write off some of this private debt in some way, shape or form. So advocates of helicopter money say, well, this is a way that you can basically give every household the same amount. Those
sounds
that are indebted,
too good to be
write
true,
it
doesn't
off.
It
does. And you said they tried it in Australia.
Well, in Australia, they didn't use the central bank to fund it. They just increased the deficit, essentially. But it was effective in reflating the economy. And I'd agree with Fran that I think if we had another crisis, that might be, in the short term, the best option.
So why don't governments just do this instead of borrowing money then?
Mainstream heterodox economic thinking. No, sorry, mainstream orthodox economic thinking.
And also, it's sort of funny, isn't it? Because when printing money was first announced, I remember Gordon Brown announced it. George Osborne attacked him, said, oh, this is terrible. We're now reduced to printing money, you know. And it then sort of became accepted because obviously it was a sensible thing to do. And it's a sort of, there's quite a lot of convention that has already been broken.
Yeah, exactly, in doing QE. And obviously having QE and austerity at
previously
the same
was associated
time
with the sort of Weimar Republic or you know, whatever. I mean, it was sort of was seen as kind of slightly crackpot, wasn't it?
I don't know, we could talk more. Josh knows a lot about where QE came from and, you know, how it was kind of invented by Richard Werner at the Bank of Japan, and it wasn't really meant to be done in the way it's been done. But I think the key is that we haven't seen enough discussion about the effects of it and the fact that essentially once you start doing QE, you know, it is kind of financial wizardry and the cat's out the bag.
But I think it's a really interesting point that if this had been a sort of major redistribution to the rich, which had been done explicitly through government,
exactly,
people would have been saying, well, hang on, is this the right thing to do? Mm. Isn't there another way of doing it? So on. But because it's all so kind of complicated and head mind-bending.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's not really that complicated, and
we'll let the listeners be the judge of that.
The central banks buy government bonds all the time in the normal process
right.
of monetary policy, right? Because they pump money into the economy when right. they think inflation is too low,
right?
And they take money out when they think
okay, that
inflation
makes it sound like
too high.
It's more normal then.
And all this is an expansion of that normal operation on a very large scale in terms of the actual
right.
procedural process.
Okay.
So they didn't need to use the word quantitative easing, I don't think.
But it is the scale of which.
But the scale is important. And there is, I mean, a democratic...
435 billion is like quite a lot.
There is an important democratic problem with it, I think, which is the decision-making process, not so much about the amount of money to create, but what sort of bonds to purchase, what sort of assets to purchase, was not subject to enough democratic scrutiny, in my opinion.
Interesting.
So, I mean, the monetary, we have this Monetary Policy Committee, which is made up of 12 independent experts. Fair enough. But we don't have the equivalent...
Nine
monetary policy experts. But we don't have the equivalent Monetary Allocation Committee, right? We don't have anyone who says...
Well, maybe we should make Jeff the chair of the Monetary Allocation Committee. Do you feel qualified after this discussion to be the chair?
I mean, I'll have a crack at it.
I think you'll do a better job.
I think I'm as qualified as anyone.
I mean, look, you've been on Radio 6, Radio 5 and Radio 2. So, I mean, you know, you could do. You could be chair of the Monetary Allocation Committee. Yeah.
You'd do a good job as the MPC, for sure.
But the point I was just trying to make, sorry, was that actually the decision was basically made by the governor and the two deputy governors behind closed doors, no real scrutiny, whether to buy government bonds, whether to buy corporate bonds, you know, what to buy. And I think that's an issue.
What's the barriers to introducing this? I mean, you know, some people might say, well, this all sounds very, very like free lunch. And what if the financial markets thought, well, this is just sort of spending gone mad, blah, blah, blah. Is that a barrier? Is that real? Is it non-real? What?
I mean, some of the financial markets think helicopter's on its way. There was a poll done of hedge funds that showed, like, I can't remember the exact figure, but a lot of them thought that helicopter was going to have to happen in one of the most advanced economies in the next kind of few years.
Because of the private debt.
And, no growth.
And secular
stagnation and basically the fact that the model of the economy for the last few decades is broken and we need to do other things. So it's been talked about a lot, but obviously within central banks, you know, they still, if they are, you know, they're questioned about it when the governor's been questioned about it by journalists, and they still dismiss it as an idea that is, you know, on the fringes.
Yes.
But I think what isn't on the fringe anymore is, you know, Josh's point around the democratic aspect of how the decision making around QE, the fact that it wasn't really scrutinised, brings into question how do central banks work and in whose interests if they are essentially maintaining financial markets rather than helping money to get into the real economy. And so where the conversation has shifted is around, you know, there's an understanding that monetary policy isn't this neutral tools that, you know, technocrats just go and do their very neutral work in the Bank of England. Actually, you know, it has real social outcomes and economic outcomes, and it is political, essentially. So
this needs to be the subject of democratic debate, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
I mean, I would advocate for, you know, a commission into monetary policy.
Chaired by Jeff.
Possibly Jeff could chair that as well. That might be a bit too much on his plate. We didn't really have that after the financial crisis. We didn't have a commission explicitly looking into the...
It's sort of making up as you go along, basically.
Creation of money by the monetary system. Yeah.
And we, you know, we've Positive Money's advocate for a long time a kind of monetary commission. And we've had various, you know, fragments of political support across all wings, you know, but obviously now we've got Brexit and it's kind of gone out the window in terms of the Treasury Select Committee. But the Treasury Select Committee do get this stuff. So just before the 2017 election, they were in the midst of doing an inquiry into QE and its problems, and we were submitting, and I was due in to give oral evidence, and then the election was called, so it got dropped, unfortunately. But, you know, people do understand that there needs to be a bit of a discussion, and this is kind of being... the conversation is building, like, across, you know, across the world.
Just one other point, which the key objection that the central banks typically make to this kind of approach is that it will inherent a loss of independence will lead to inflationary outcomes. Now that argument's become increasingly weak in the last 30 years.
Because inflation's so low.
Because inflation's been below target since the crisis, almost everywhere. So central banks have been consistently missing their target. It's been too low. So I think you need to... And what has been happening is enormous asset price inflation.
Yes.
House prices going up. Price of shares has been going up. So there needs to be a configuration there, reconfiguration.
And do any countries do quantitative easing in the way that you recommend?
No. So, yeah, so the main QE programs have been carried out in the US, the UK, Japan, and the ECB, and all of them have been done essentially in the way that we've...
Yeah, I mean, Japan's been slightly different in the sense that the central bank's presented its QE program as a package with a highly expansionary fiscal policy. The opposite of what's happened here, where they did QE and the government contracted spending. So I think that's a more sensible way of doing it. The Treasury and the central bank working together, we need to reflate the economy, we'll increase spending, we'll create this money to support it.
So we dream of a utopia on this podcast, which is the Jeffocracy. I'm a benign leader. I wouldn't renounce my role as head of the Monetary Allocation Committee. But if I were to appoint the two of you joint, I mean, would it be Governor of the Bank of England, do you think? Would it be
great.
The Chancellor?
Job
what,
share.
Yeah, what would be the thing you did day one, first thing?
I would essentially create a new piece of legislation that would require all banks to ensure that 30% of all their lending supported the real economy, non-financial firms, not mortgages, not lending to other financial firms, but supported real businesses. And I would also give the Bank of England a secondary inflation target for house price inflation. So keep house price inflation 1%, 2%. I think that would help.
I'd probably also get rid of the current Monetary Policy Committee and get some new people involved, have a few more radical ideas and people that would support the idea of monetary financing or QE for people.
So you'd have a Night of the Long Knives?
Potentially. I wouldn't do it on day one.
Right.
But I think we need some less pale, male and stale men running the Bank of England and think about getting some new ideas in there. I'd also get the Bank of England to commit to looking at climate change in terms of its monetary policy operations and getting sustainability hardwired into its mandate.
Agreed.
Great. Fran, Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
So what did you think?
Well, firstly, it did make my head spin a little bit. There were definitely bits where I was struggling to follow it.
Me too, and I've got a master's in economics. So.
Okay, well, I don't feel quite so bad about myself now. I mean, it needs looking at. If it's this, you know, massive undertaking that the government did in the wake of the financial crisis, and it's had this outcome of more inequality and wealth ending up in the hands of the rich getting richer and so on. I'm really interested in the different ways of doing it. The sort of bit of head scratching that I've been doing is, what does it do to the independence of the Bank of England? You know, how if the Bank of England is choosing to invest in this QE in different kinds of ways, how is that not politicised? But I guess they would say it's politicised anyway, if you look where the money went.
Obviously, that's something you'd have to handle as chair of the Monetary Allocation Committee. I think your analysis, I kind of really agree with. I think the reason it's good we did it is that, you know, there's been this massive undertaking, massive impact on the economy, on distribution, on who's being supported, with no public debate at all, but it's so head-scratchingly confusing, complicated, and hard to understand. And I think it is right that there's a debate about it. I think you're also right to say, well, maybe people would say, well, this is interfering with the Bank of England, but I mean, they're having a massive distributional impact apart from anything else. And how is that not a political sort of question?
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So we'd love to hear from you if you've been inspired by what you've heard about quantitative easing and how it could be done differently. Tell us your thoughts. Give us ideas for future episodes. You can email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Find us on Twitter at Cheerful Podcast. We're on Instagram as well, and facebook.com/reasons to be cheerful podcast.
You can do it while you're at the Leisure Centre as well.
This comes from Dr. Malcolm White in Glasgow. Firstly, Malcolm talks about the climate change and plastics that we talked about last week and suggests that we should all be writing to our MPs and MSPs re-climate change. Do you find like a personalised email from a constituent has more weight than, you know, a petition or just a cut and paste thing?
Definitely. And I'm afraid I think MPs have sort of got to the stage where they tend to pay less attention to the sort of standard email. Whereas I think specific, I mean, they don't pay no attention, but I think the more personal, the better, yeah.
He continues, another issue close to my heart that would make an interesting podcast topic would be that of industry-led consumerism. I'm studying a master's in obesity, and one of the drivers of Western obesity and pollution is the consumerist culture. Obesity itself would, of course, make a very interesting podcast, but it would be a worthwhile challenge to address the topic without just blaming people for their size, fat-shaming. So much of obesity is outside of a person's control and driven by industrial processed food and drink, poverty, genetics, and so on, government policy, and many more causes.
This one comes from Matthew Cracknell. I was really struck by the excellent Karen McCluskey for your live show on gang knife crime. That was the one from Edinburgh. And I was particularly interested in her ideas on early intervention and early years care. I'd love to know more about what that could look like in practice. I appreciate that governments often have a need for instant tangible results, but I really think if done properly, early intervention is going to have real long-term benefits. Related to this is the idea of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and the role trauma can play in impacting people's lives. And he's linked to a couple of articles which talk about this. Keep up the good work. Kind regards, Matt Cracknell.
This comes from Else, who says, hi, Ed and Jeff. And Else suggests that we do an episode about challenges faced by policing in the UK at the moment, which would be a good idea for an episode. Yeah. Else also adds, anyway, thank you for the podcast, and I'll keep spreading the word. I've got two people listening so far. It's turning into a bit of a cult. Maybe there should be some kind of secret handshake involved.
Have you ever had anyone give you a secret handshake?
No. I mean, I'm guessing that any Freemasons that I've met have looked at me and thought...
What is a Masonic one?
Isn't it? Do you get your index finger and do a little tickle on the palm of the hand?
It happened to me. I can't exactly remember where it happened to me, but it happened to me. I think it was before I was an MP.
Somebody just assumed that you...
Well, somebody did that handshake with me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's somebody thinking, oh, he's one of the shadowy... elite. Nobody's ever thought that about me.
No, I didn't do it.
But suggestions for reasons to be cheerful, handshake.
It couldn't be the same as a Masonic one, I don't think.
No, because it's probably trademarked.
Probably. Yeah. This one comes from Eva de Volk. Hi, Ed and Jeff. I have recently found my own reason to be cheerful. I've become involved with The Good Country. The Good Country is a new project by Simon Anholt. They've quite literally started a new country that everyone can become a citizen of. The idea is that people from all over the world who share the good country's belief in global citizenship become a big international community and show the rest of the world that working together we will have a much better chance of tackling global challenges like climate change, inequality and migration. Citizens are empowered to learn more about these issues and contribute in whatever way they can, whether it's spreading the word about the good country or getting involved in drafting policies. When I joined, I immediately thought of reasons to be cheerful, as this seems like the kind of initiative you would cover on the podcast.
That sounds great. I think a good name for it might be the Jeffocracy, rather than the good country.
Maybe we should suggest it's more catchy than the good country.
Yeah.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
And joining us now to pitch some ideas, comedian Eleanor Morton. Hello.
Hello.
I'm looking at you and straight away I feel like I have an ally. Because a conversation that sometimes crops up on this podcast is, Ed, you would move somewhere sunny in a heartbeat, wouldn't you?
Definitely.
Whereas, Eleanor, you look like me, you prefer to skulk in the shadows.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm from Edinburgh, so that's what I'm used to.
Eleanor, you've brought some ideas along with you. Do you want to talk us through? What's your first one?
My first one is there should be a freelancer card, like a student card, discount card. And that is because we live in a world where people, grown adults, still need discounts for things because the economy is terrible. And this is mostly to benefit me and my friends.
I think it's a really good idea.
So what would you be getting discounts on as a freelancer?
This is like... just everything students would rail. Get. Yeah, rail, travel,
buses,
museums.
You're going to get buses, do you?
Yeah.
You do, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Some of them do. Entrance to things, cultural stuff.
What about coffee?
Coffee, yes, because that's mostly what we...
Do you get a student discount for coffee?
Well, no, but freelancers drink a lot of coffee. There are coffee shops on their computers, aren't they? Yeah. Although I always feel guilty if I'm doing that because I think I'm taking up a lot of time.
I always...
So I try and buy at least a coffee every 45 minutes to compensate.
That's really good. You've got such a social conscience.
I do.
You do.
Why are you surprised about that?
I don't know. 58 episodes in, I'm shocked.
I always just go to like a big chain coffee shop and then I don't feel guilty.
Right. So you've got social conscience too, but if it's an independent coffee shop, you would buy it every 45
minutes.
Yes,
I would definitely. And I'd be very much... And I'd want to enjoy it more. I probably wouldn't work there. I only go to Starbucks and the places like that because I know they don't really care.
I'm in favour of this, by the way.
It's a good idea.
I mean, actually, to be honest, we should go the whole hog and freelancers should have like the welfare state as well.
Yeah, that would
be
really nice. You know what I mean? Please.
Like pension, sick pay,
maternity leave.
You know, all of this, you know, it's like, I mean, it sort of goes very wide, doesn't it?
I mean,
I was about to say Amazon, and obviously it's not freelancers, but it's a similar gig economy.
Yeah, and it's more and more, I think, people are doing freelance stuff and go freelance. So that would be nice, just because, you know, it does take a lot of money to do a lot of things.
All right, what do you have next for us, Eleanor?
All adults should get an adult box on their 18th birthday.
Oh, now this is like in Finland. If you have a baby, you get a box of stuff when they're born.
They introduced it in Scotland last year.
Aha.
Just in time for my friend who's having a baby. I thought it was just amazing. You get so much stuff. You get clothes, you get a little mattress, you get sort of feeding equipment, booklets on stuff.
Dare I ask what is going to be in the adult box?
Yeah, I did think it sounded a bit...
adult.
I mean a booklet on how taxes work.
Oh, I see what you mean. Right, I'm getting your drift.
Preparing you for being an adult.
I see.
So...
Mittens?
Yes, because it's cold.
Yeah. You're not talking about some naughty things.
No. Things that adults need.
You throw in a couple of naughty things.
Yeah, no, I think condoms and things to be responsible.
No, not naughty, exactly.
But, you know, I think maybe like a 5-pack of socks and...
Yes.
Just, you know, a recipe book, just a whole bunch of stuff no one teaches you at school.
Picture of wheat fields.
Yes, lovely, just for fun, just for those naughty
adult
things.
Colouring book.
Yeah, that's good for
adult
stress.
Colouring book. That's a thing people do for mindfulness.
It's very relaxing.
What is an adult colouring book?
Well, again,
small A.
Yeah.
Right, I see.
It's just lovely pictures and patterns.
There's a Jeremy Corbyn colouring book.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. There's one for everything.
Would you like it for Christmas?
No. It's making me think, though, maybe we should do a colouring book as merch.
Maybe. Right, okay, we're into the adult box, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else you got for us?
Parliament should be a moving roadshow.
Yeah.
So this would be like the Radio 1 roadshow. They'd be throwing out T-shirts, playing fun games.
Just, obviously, I think, you know, it doesn't make sense in today's world to have a parliament in one place. Because I used to work for an MP, Chris Law, in the SNP.
Oh, right. Plus, you worked in Parliament.
I worked in Parliament, yes.
Wow.
In Portcullis House.
Wow.
Just for a couple of months.
And you lived to tell the tale.
Yeah. Well, I sort of was like, this isn't a good day job for a comedian. You can't really do both.
Or this isn't a good day job.
But it was great to get a free tour of Westminster, because it's about 20 quid to do it as a tourist. So
you'd recommend getting a job there to save on the admission
price?
Absolutely,
yes. Yeah, no, so it became apparent, especially MPs in like the north of Scotland and stuff, you have to work for a couple of days and then go home for a couple of days, and it just seems crazy, the amount of travel. So if it went around the UK...
I mean, I think in principle it's a really good idea, and I thought, because we have to move out of Parliament, you know, because of it's all falling down.
So I
thought, why can't we move it to Birmingham? But, I mean, apparently the costs are sort of absolutely astronomical.
I can imagine, why Birmingham? Just because it's...
Well, I don't know, because I thought it was nearby. I mean, sort of, you know, you can imagine on HS2 when we move out, we'll be able to get there quickly and blah, blah. You know, Parliament is just like, I don't know, I think it's incredibly off-putting for people. I think the whole thing, I mean, imagine if it came to a community, it would be a big deal.
Well, that's the thing, you could make it like Antiques Roadshow, you know, you could have events and you could talk to them.
Is that a comment on the MPs? That's more the House of Lords, actually.
That would be a whole different roadshow.
So I've discovered an 80-year-old lord. How much is he worth?
Yeah, it would just go around the country and it would be... big event, everyone could go and talk to their MPs.
Also, it'd be totally transformative in terms of the sort of opening up and the accessibility. I think if you could find a way of pulling this off, it would be really good.
Okay.
All right, what else you got, Eleanor?
Everyone should be paid the same, which isn't funny, but I just think that's my opinion.
Absolutely the same.
Absolutely the same. I mean, I really haven't thought about it enough.
So like, your job is hard, thinking up jokes and writing things out of thin air. What would stop you from thinking, oh, I'm not going to do that, I'll just be a night watchman instead and sit doing a word search for 8 hours?
But that might be more useful to people, you know, people need night watchmen.
But also, she loves being a comedian, don't you?
Yeah. Sometimes.
Are there any other... I mean, I can't think of a single other flaw with this plan.
I mean, you could have more equal...
The idea is that...
I think more equal than now. I'm very totally in favour of that.
Yeah, definitely.
Because the idea is that, like, you know, people think something like quite low-paid, like being a bin man, is actually just as equally important to society as being a businessman or a lawyer or a banker or a doctor, because if a bin man stops doing his job, then that's pretty bad for the country. You know, everything's piling up.
And I mean, what must be right... I mean, the way the market rewards, who it rewards for how much, is absolutely has no... very little connection to social usefulness.
Yes.
I mean, I always think of people who look after the elderly. It's such an important job, and they get paid the worst wages.
Yeah, and also, you know, people say they work harder than someone else, but, you know, if we all feel exactly the same amount tired at the end of the day, then, you know, haven't we all worked the same amount of you know.
Is this part of the Jeffocracy? More equal is part of the Jeffocracy, is my guess.
Yeah, more equal, I think. I'm just thinking of lazy people like me.
Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't spoken to an economist about it because I feel like they'd point out a lot of flaws immediately.
Is your show about politics?
I don't really talk about politics in my show because I just get too angry and depressed. But those are the ideas.
Very good. Great. We like them.
Yeah. Eleanor Morton, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So there we go, the end of another podcast. Here we are again in the outro.
Remember.
Oh, because this podcast will come out on Guy Fawkes night. Yeah.
Yes.
Are you a fan?
I'm a pet.
Oh, so you're saying, you know,
I stay indoors.
Yeah.
And try not to bark at the window.
Yeah. It is awful. It is awful for animals, actually.
Well, I wasn't really thinking of the animals. I was thinking of myself. I'm a bit underwhelmed by fireworks, I'm afraid.
That's a very interesting aspect of your personality. Yeah. Because, you know, I don't like the way fireworks upset animals and things. But then when I'm looking at them, they're quite spectacular. But you just think, meh.
Are they not like, once you've seen one set, you've seen them all?
Yeah, but you don't see them that often, do you?
Maybe. I remember going to the Millennium Fireworks, you know, 1999. And I remember being really underwhelmed. I still stood in the cold on the bridge and the blah. Do you remember? It was a whole thing about them. I mean, at least I wasn't at the Dome having to sort of, you know, putting the Queen in an embarrassing position trying to sing Auld Lang Syne with her. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. An interesting thing is I associate fireworks with cold weather, crisp cold evenings.
Oh, that's quite nice.
But my wife, being American, she thinks of hot weather because they have them on the 4th of July.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? They must have different associations.
Penny for the Guys sort of faded out, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think it's been superseded by trick or treat, hasn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? The way these cultural trends.
Yeah.
But are you going to the fireworks?
I'm not. I might sort of check a few bonfires for hedgehogs as an act of community service beforehand.
That speaks very well for you.
Yeah, but no, I don't think so.
Should we do our thank yous?
We should.
I'm going to thank Fran Boyt and Josh Ryan Collins for an excellent discussion.
And I'd like to thank Eleanor Morton for excellent ideas. Emma Corsham produces our podcast. Our idents were made by James Deacon. Ed Seed composed the music and the
Emily artwork.
Emily Power. Yeah.
He's been a hedgehog rescuer.
He's been a baked potato in tinfoil.
And these have been
reasons to be
cheerful.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president. You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.